Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Around 750 million people live on the European continent. So what about it? What will its future look like? Will there ever be a United States of Europe? For this and more, you will hear from European thought leaders, artists, civil society representatives, and all those who care about its future. You will receive key insights into the ways Europe is changing and how your voice can be part of this. I am Paolo De Stilo, and you're listening to Europe Matters. In this episode, it is my great honor to introduce you to the Dutch poet and writer Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer. Distinguished in nearly every genre imaginable, he is one of the most celebrated authors of the Dutch language. He has more than 40 titles to his name, including poetry, novels, short stories, plays, essays, scientific studies, columns, translations, and anthologies. He's the only Dutch author who has won major debut prizes for both poetry and prose. He experienced an international breakthrough with La Superba in 2013. The book was a bestseller and has been published in several countries like the United States of America, Germany, and Italy. However, at the end of 2018, Grand Hotel Europa appeared, a grand novel about love in times of mass tourism, nostalgia, and European identity. The book was applauded in Dutch and Belgian press and immediately became a bestseller. So we are currently in Genoa. Thank you very much for accepting this invitation.
Thank you for coming and thank you very much for your very kind introduction.
Yeah, so first of all, you're from the Netherlands, which is very flat, and we find ourselves kind of on a hill here in Italy. How come you've decided to come here to Genoa?
Yes, in Liguria, it's very difficult to find one square meter that is flat. Yeah. So I guess I wanted it to be as different as it could be. No, but in fact, it wasn't even a very decision I thought very much about. It was all a coincidence, actually. It was in summer 2008 that I ended up here in Genoa during a vacation. And by lack of a better word, I fell in love with this city. And quite spontaneously, I decided that it would perhaps be a good idea for me to stay here for a little while, I thought.
That little while now has become like 13 years almost?
Yes, now yeah. 13 years, this little while. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And we are actually kind of looking at one of a very special place, the Cathedrale di San Lorenzo.
Yeah, we have a nice view on the cathedral, yes.
And one of the things that you highlight a lot in your works is history, especially if we look at Italy. It's covered in history that there's like kind of a struggle for Europeans with their past.
Yeah, that's very true. No, actually, this has everything to do also with the fact that I moved from Holland to Italy 13 years ago. This translocation had a couple of consequences. Now, after a while, I started to feel a little bit less Dutch, which I think is only very sound for a person. I started to feel a little bit more Italian, which is also a very happy consequence. But most importantly, I realized that I was starting to feel more European.
And what does that mean, to feel European?
That is exactly the question I was asking myself. Yeah. What does it mean to feel European? What is a European identity? And actually, it's this personal question of mine that is at the root of the novel Grand Hotel Europe. And when you start thinking about that question, perhaps you don't even have to think that much to realize that one of the main characteristics of the old continent is the omnipresence of the past. The past is everywhere. And I mean also the past really in a physical, tangible sense. No? We are surrounded by remnants of our glorious history. There are monuments everywhere. We're looking on the Cathedral of Genoa from the 11th century. And for us, these are our riches. No, this is something we are very proud of. We feel good about it, to be surrounded by all this past.
You found it here in Italy. Did you miss that in the Netherlands, for example?
Well, of course, it's also in the Netherlands. I used to live in the historical center of the city of Leiden, which is a very, very cute little town from the 16th, 17th century. So the history is also there, but here in Italy, it's really overwhelming. I think that half of the world heritage is on Italian soil.
Yeah, that's what Italians love to say. Yes, there's like more than half, but that's also true. For example, everywhere that they try to create a metro or stuff like that, they always find or Romans or Etrurian
stuff. It's better not to construct metros because no, you're destined to find everything, and that's the problem. Now, this omnipresence of the past, which is our pride, perhaps also has another side to it. Now, it can also be a hindrance. In my book, somebody says somewhere that in Europe there is so much past that there is no space left anymore for a future.
But isn't that too cynical as a way of thinking about Europe?
Well, it is a diagnosis. If it is an illness, there may also be a cure. But no, it has two sides to it, because of course we love this past, but it is also, it has the danger in it of nostalgia, of being stuck in the past. No? And of course, the point is to balance these two aspects, which are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, so for the listeners who still haven't had the chance to read your book.
I don't think there are many.
So can we give a little sketch of what's going on? No? You yourself are the writer in the book, or you kind of perceive yourself, or you describe
an author. The protagonist of the book is somebody with a very improbable name, Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer. He looks a bit like me, but okay. It isn't really me. No, it's not an autobiographical book. It is a book of fiction. Yes, and this Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer of the book, he arrives at this place, this hotel, which is the Grand Hotel Europe that gives the book its title, which is an old grand hotel, which is exactly as you would want it to be. It's a bit falling to pieces, but it has still the smell of the glorious days of the past. And he is going there in order to write and to think about what went wrong with the love of his life. So half of the book is him being in a hotel, and the other half is him looking back on this incredible love story with Cleo. They met in Genoa here, but then soon they move to Venice because Cleo gets a job there. And most part of this love story is set in Venice. And of course, this is not a coincidence, because Venice is perhaps the most extreme example of a city where there is so much past that there is literally no place left for a future. In Venice, you cannot construct any skyscraper or any metro or new building. No.
And the image that might some people might receive is that actually whole of Europe is kind of becoming a living Disneyland for tourists, where people go and just see the past.
Yes, and because a large part of the story is set in Venice, tourism is a very important theme in the book. And this is also, an effect of this omnipresence of this past. No? Because, of course, when you live your life surrounded by glorious monuments from the past, it's tempting sooner or later to conclude that perhaps the best times are behind us. And also this nostalgia is in the core of European identity. But there are also perhaps objective reasons to come to the same conclusion that Europe has seen better times in the past. For instance, geopolitically, no? The times when the nations of Europe ruled the seven seas of the world and colonized the continents is definitely behind us. And it's all for the best like that, don't get me wrong. But it means that Europe arrived at a point in history where it has to redefine itself. It has to redefine its position between rising and declining superpowers. It's also true economically, I think. And this is perhaps more visible here in the south than in the north of Europe. But a country like Italy has increasing difficulties of maintaining a good old-fashioned proper economy, in the sense of an economy based on heavy industry, shipbuilding, and that kind of thing. This doesn't make sense anymore. It's more and more difficult to face the competition of rising economies in the East. So also economically, Europe has to reinvent itself. And one of the things you see, and again, it's something you see more in the South than in the North, is that as an alternative model of making money, an alternative economical model, they turn to this main characteristic of the European continent, which is the omnipresence of the past. And this past is something you can sell.
But haven't we seen through this pandemic of 1 year and a half, still ongoing, it's a piece of economy that is very susceptible to changes like a pandemic?
Yes, exactly. Well, I am very critical about this new economical model based on mass tourism. I don't think it's a very viable alternative. And the pandemic is one reason to come to this conclusion that it is perhaps not a very good idea to base an entire economy on a touristic monoculture. We have seen how vulnerable that is. We have seen the images of Venice empty during
the pandemic.
Oh,
that was beautiful.
It was beautiful. But it was also extremely tragic.
Yep.
Because you also realize that Venice without tourism doesn't stand a chance to survive. There's nothing left there. There are not even any inhabitants left, hardly. So I think what the pandemic showed us is the real problem of Venice during the pandemic was not the absence of tourists. The real problem was the absence of an alternative to tourism.
And also no citizens.
They all fled away. Yeah. And it's important to realize that. It's important to realize that tourism is not at all an innocuous phenomenon. Tourism can be very damaging. It can be damaging to the social infrastructures of a city, of a country. And Venice is a very extreme example, but the very same tendencies you see everywhere. You see also in the historical center of Amsterdam, in Prague, in Barcelona, in other Italian cities, always the same mechanisms, that when a city starts to enjoy the interests of tourists, you end up with rising house prices, more facilities for tourists, less facilities for inhabitants, and in the end, inhabitants leave.
So now there's various themes as well that you tackle in your book. Beyond the huge critical factor of tourism and the way that Europe is trying to find a new way of sustaining itself and also finding its place in the new universe that is creating itself right now. But there's other phenomena like immigration that has always been very, very negatively seen, whereas for others, if we're looking at people more on the left, they're seen as the solution to the problem. And you, specific pieces, you give some room to it. You give space to this Abdul, who actually escaped and actually went to Europe, but in very gruesome ways. Europe has been very colonial in the ways that it has executed its powers. And could we even say that it's still colonial in the ways that it's dealing with its past, but also with the current situation of immigrations, refugees, and everything else? There's still this kind of feeling of the outsider is not welcome.
Well, in effect, we're talking about effects of globalization here, no? Both tourism and immigration are different effects of globalization. And there is, of course, a very grim contrast between the two. And I became very acutely aware of that in real life when I was in Malta. Because we all know that Malta is the other Lampedusa, no? It's also the destination of many refugees from Africa. But the surprising thing was that while I was there in Malta, in Valletta, I was there for a week, I didn't see one black person. And that is very strange. And then I researched a bit and I discovered that it's also very much part of deliberate Maltese policy. The refugees that arrived there are kept hidden because they don't want to damage the tourism. And of course, that's very paradoxical, no? That in order not to scare the wealthy white travelers that are looking for a past, they have to expel the poor black travelers who are looking for a future. You say that this is a colonial attitude. Yes, perhaps it is. I think it's most of all it's short-sightedness. Because when we talk about immigration, I think one of the lessons that history teaches us is that immigration can never be stopped. And in the case of the African refugees trying to come to Europe, if you see the risks they are willing to take, if you see that they are easily willing to risk their lives to get here, you understand something of the desperation, and they are not stopped by anything. So I don't think it's very fruitful to think about ways of stopping them. I think it's about time to think in a different way. If they are coming, perhaps it's better to think about ways in which we can use them, in which they can be useful members of our society, you know?
Become citizens,
yeah.
Instead of being immigrants.
Yes, and of course this takes a bit of an investment, no? Perhaps you have to give them schooling and that kind of thing. But I think this is, on the long run, it's a much more intelligent idea than trying to stop them.
This also goes with the thought that we have of borders. No, Europe is an interesting project. The European Union, at least, it's a very interesting project of trying to get collaboration between now 27 member states to collaborate and actually further integration between each other to do commercial activities, at least. Now we're also seeing that we want more of a political European Union, but it's still based on borders, and that we saw during the pandemic, everybody closed their borders last yes. year. Yeah. And that actually shows that the way people still think is very much about their own piece of land, their own small territory. So everybody thought that the pandemic was only to Italy at the beginning. No, the coronavirus was only stable and would only stay in Italy, but it didn't. It came all the way up to the north.
Yeah, this is of course also because healthcare is not seen as a European matter. No, it's very much.
There is one part that is a European matter, but it's still it wasn't being considered at the time, but it still is in the treaties. But they never promoted or never have actually acted on it.
There's too much money going around in healthcare, so the national governments want to keep control, I think. But anyway, now when you talk about borders, I think it's important to realize that it is perhaps the most daring, most beautiful project ever undertaken by mankind, unifying Europe. It is, of course, painstakingly slow and difficult and frustrating, but we're making progress slowly. And when you imagine directly after the Second World War, the idea of unifying Europe, abolishing internal borders, this would have been a dream. And actually, we are realizing that dream. It's not perfect yet. We still have a lot of work to do, but we are getting there. And with the pandemic, we had this fallback on national borders, which is a pity. And when you're talking about identity, I think it's also very important to realize that one identity doesn't exclude another. It's important to realize that you can be both Dutch and European.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In my case, perhaps, I think my first identity now is Genoese. My second identity is Dutch. And my third identity is European. Perhaps two or three are turned around. I don't know.
Where's the Italian identity?
Oh, that's four, perhaps. I feel more European than Italian. I'm not sure if I feel more Dutch than European. But anyway, you can have many identities, no? Yeah. And I think actually that Italy, the country Italy, can be an example for Europe, because the unification of Italy in the mid-19th century made a political unity. But for the rest, we can also say that it failed, because all the cultural differences between the regions are still very much there, are very relevant. And this is actually also the wealth of Italy, all these differences, these cultural, regional differences. And this works perfectly. And I think this can be a model for Europe in a way that it demonstrates that a political unity doesn't mean that you have to abolish all the cultural differences. Actually, you have to keep them.
One of the things that I've heard you talk about is the United States of Europe. And already in those three words, you're actually talking about states. Are you talking about nation states or are you talking about states?
Well, it's a provocation.
Yeah.
The United States of Europe would be the end point. It would be like the United States of America, no? That the unification is complete and that Europe is a single state called the United States of Europe.
But isn't that too much an American dream? Then,
well, we can also use a different name for it. But I use that term to. I'm not the only one. No, it's people who are dreaming of a federal Europe, talking it in terms of the United States of Europe.
So we're talking about more of a federalist.
Yeah, I think we need more Europe. We need a stronger political unity.
So should we imagine more of a regional unity, more based on regions instead of states?
Yeah, well, actually, there are many studies that demonstrate that that identity nowadays and also political power is much more concentrated on cities. Like I myself, I identify with the city of Genoa. Of course, it's very easy to find somebody living in New York who feels very much connected to the city of New York, but doesn't feel perhaps so much connected with the United States of America. So if you imagine a federal state of Europe in which all these cultural differences and, well, of course, you also need local politics. You also need politics that are close to the people, as they are centered on cities, perhaps more so than on regions. I think that that would not be such a bad model.
But isn't that too cosmopolitan as an idea? Because then
it's entirely cosmopolitan, but it's also the beginning, because after we have the United States of Europe, of course, we need the United States of the world. United Federation of Planets, as
exactly.
In Star Trek.
Yeah. Yes.
That's where we should get.
Okay. So those are the ideals, or at least one of the ideals that you strive for or you think about.
Yeah, but I also think that it is absolutely not original to strive for that, because what would be the alternative? To strive for ever more diversity, ever more strife, ever more. Yeah. I don't think that is a very fruitful way. So it's for me, it's totally logical.
So should we actually create a new story about realms, kings for our future instead of a very republican way of thinking?
Why do we need kings?
Okay, that's a good one.
No, I think, well, with all its faults and defects, we still haven't discovered a better system than democracy, I think. Even if democracy right now doesn't show itself from its best sight, but I don't think that, well, of course, Holland is blessed with a very good king. We could make Willem-Alexander, we could make him king of Europe. That would be a good idea, perhaps.
Democracy and everything, that is a unoriginal idea in the sense of the way of how we would like to think about the future of Europe. No, there's currently the Conference on the Future of Europe, which is a trilateral endeavor from the European Parliament, the European Commission, and the European Council. And that is actually a one-year-long conference. Many people don't know about this, but it's a multi-digital platform online where you can just write in your ideas. But that also makes it kind of not very appealing. No, it's like...
There's a bit of one of the problems with Europe now, that there are many things that many people don't know about. It's not seen as a very sexy subject. No, newspapers don't write very much about it.
Yeah, so for example, there's now currently there's a growing very small party, which is Volt, which tries to actually bring to European politics to to the national government, which is an interesting concept, which also other parties, like, for example, DiEM25 tried years back with Varoufakis. And Europe is just not sexy. So why is it not sexy for your, why do you think it's so not sexy?
I think because people don't feel very much involved. And one of the problems of Europe is that it should be more democratic. So we need more Europe, but we also need a more democratic Europe.
Okay. And should there be more storytellers to talk about the democratic side?
Yeah, and storytellers should be paid much more.
Okay. So please buy the book of Ilya, because there's a dear need of financing. I think in the whole sector, the whole arts sector, really needs more attention in general.
It's one of the things that that the pandemic taught us now, how absolutely fundamental the arts are. It's really, it defines what we are, and we cannot, we really cannot survive without books, films, music, paintings. It's just as important as food, air, and water.
What did you miss the most during this whole pandemic?
I missed very much going to the theater. Of course, reading books was something I could still do, but going to a theater is a very special experience that that cannot be substituted by seeing a DVD, as our minister suggested.
Which minister? The Dutch one?
Yeah, the Dutch minister, yeah. De Jong. One of his arguments for keeping the theaters closed, even if all the big shops were already open, was that people can also watch a DVD.
Current theme, no, is tourism, but also the way of selling out the continent, no, of kind of leaving it empty. We also saw that during the pandemic, that it kind of got emptied out, but not only Europe, the world in general, and the way that it has been tackled, but the example that you just bring of arts being left out as the last one to be opened up, that actually kind of shows that also the mentality around the arts has been kind of deterred. But is that due to globalization only, or is that also because we are kind of bored from the arts?
No, I think neoliberalism is to blame. We have all grown up with the idea that something can only have value if this value can be expressed in economical terms. Finally, after centuries, millennia of philosophy, we have found our destiny, and our destiny is to consume. Neoliberalism teaches us we are consumers, and it's all about money. And when something like the art cannot be easily expressed in economical terms, it is very quickly concluded that it cannot have any value. And you see that with the liberal governments we have had in the Netherlands and also in other countries, that they don't think that art is very important because it cannot be economically expressed. Even if, of course, it can be economically quantified. I read a very interesting study of this accountancy. Was it Ernst & Young? Yes, it was Ernst & Young who estimated the economical value of the creative industry, including all the arts and that kind of thing, in Europe. And it's bigger than the automobile industry. It's bigger than big tech. It's a huge sector.
So should the economy of Europe restart from the arts?
Well, that's something we have always been very good at, no? So perhaps it's not a bad idea to concentrate on that.
It seems, I think, a good piece of advice also for our listeners to maybe go into the arts. And
for our politicians. It is perhaps a sector that it's perhaps a very clever idea to stimulate a sector, because it's very, very good.
Yeah, because one of the thoughts, no, that you just mentioned neoliberalism, and it actually starts off from this assumption that the economy is based on scarcity, or at least goods are scarce, and therefore there's more value added to the things that are scarce. And we see that that has brought housing prices in a lot of cities. Certain goods are almost impossible to buy because they're scarce. And that actually has also changed the way we engage with each other. It's also kind of, it creates more, of course, it's, it gives more freedom to each individual, but at the same time, it creates more of a fragmented society. So what kind of way should we look forward to in your eyes?
Yeah, you touch on different things. You say, actually, this fragmented society is very much a problem. But that brings us, I think, to something completely different. I think that one of the effects of the invention of internet is this fragmentation. Of course, internet is still a very recent thing. I remember, I'm a bit older than you are, but I remember the very first time I went on internet. It was when I was in the Royal Holloway College of London in 1995. I was doing my PhD, actually, so half of my life was in the analog era. So I realized very much how recent it is. And, well, it's, what is it, 25 years ago that it was introduced in a major university in the United Kingdom. So we still have to learn to deal with it. It's a very recent thing. But you still can, you already can see the huge impact it has on society. The way in which we see knowledge, because now we have Google. The way we treat specialists, because now we think that we are all specialists because we have Google. And our idea of that every single individual has the right to...
expression.
Yeah, to express opinions that should be listened to now, because they have this possibility to publicize. And one of the effects is also this fragmentation, because also because of the algorithms that are designed in a way that they give you exactly what they think you like, and they think you like what you have seen before.
So can history, now the beauties, the arts, integrate with these technological developments?
No, I think they can be a counterbalance. I think art can be a way of getting you out of your bubble. It can be a way to wake up, to see things a little bit differently. If only for 5 minutes, I think that can be very useful. All good art has this effect, now that it changes you, if only for 5 minutes, that it makes you see things in a different way. And that's exactly the opposite of what your internet bubble is doing. So it can be, I think, a balance to it. And it's also very, very important to realize, I think, that if you realize what all the debates are that we are having, all the debates that are dividing our country, I'm thinking of the Netherlands now, are in fact cultural debates. When we're talking about all the debates are about identity, about Zwarte Piet, about what it means to be Dutch, what it means to have a Dutch history with slave trade, or all these kind of things. All these discussions that divide the society to the bone are cultural discussions. So perhaps it's good to invest in cultural literacy.
So what you're actually suggesting is that to start a European identity, or at least European identities, different ones, we should talk about cultural diversity and the fact that there's various cultures and that there should be interaction with them.
Yes, yes. And if you think about it, it's always been like that. No, if you think about the Renaissance, about 15th, 16th century, European culture has always been a European conversation, a cultural conversation between, well, in the beginning, it's mainly intellectuals, of course, between humanists of all different countries, different backgrounds, different languages, but engaging always in this conversation. And I think that is actually the blueprint for a European unity.
Okay.
It shouldn't be like the European equivalent of an American melting pot, that we have one big Disneyland, Coca-Cola, barbecue daddy culture. No, we should keep all our different cultures, languages, but the conversation is important.
And but that's the biggest problem, because there's like 24 official languages within...
A language is never a problem. We are talking now. We can also talk.
That's true.
We have 5 languages that we can talk. People understand each other. Language is not a problem.
Yep. What is then the problem?
Problem is short-sightedness. People should reach out to have a conversation and not to be afraid and stay in their bubble because they are afraid of people that are maybe a bit different.
So it's mainly fear.
Yeah, fear is a problem. Yeah.
Okay.
It's also globalization brings a lot of fear.
Yeah. I'm scared now.
No, you shouldn't.
Okay, thank you, everybody. This was Ilja Leonard Pfeiffer. Thank you very much for having accepted my invitation.
And it was a huge pleasure. Thank you.
And it was an honor to get to know you and to have this interview actually face-to-face, which is also a true honor, because in these current times, it's not very usual anymore to see people in their bones and flesh.
I'm also very happy about that, yes.
Grazie mille.
Grazie a te.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Europe Matters. Special thanks goes to my assistant producer, Antonio Mattesini. Let us know who we should interview next by writing a comment and sharing it with your friends on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn using the handle @EuropeMatters. Don't forget to leave a review on whichever podcast streaming platform you use. And if you really like this show, the best way to support us is by making a donation on patreon.com. You can learn more at www.europematters.com. Speak to you soon.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer.
Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.